Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations and by Mark Air and Mark Air Express.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly. More on the Exxon Valdez oil spill disaster tonight. Captain Hazelwood's lawyer says he may return voluntarily to face criminal charges. And the herring season in Prince William Sound has been canceled. Good evening. I'm Corey Flintoff. Also tonight, two first-hand reports from reporters in the field in Prince William Sound, Bob King on the cleanup of Green Island, and Claire Richardson in the Bird and Animal Rehabilitation Center. An attorney for fired Exxon Valdez skipper Joseph Hazelwood says the captain may return to Alaska, where he's wanted on criminal charges stemming from the oil spill disaster. That news came from the Attorney General's office as North America's largest oil spill continued to ooze out of Prince William Sound and into the Gulf of Alaska. Peter Kenyon has this update.
Alaska's Criminal Prosecutions Director Larry Weeks told the Associated Press that Hazelwood, who apparently still has not been located, may be willing to surrender voluntarily. He faces charges of commanding a tanker while intoxicated, reckless endangerment, and negligence in connection with the spill of over 10 million gallons into Prince William Sound. The FBI is also conducting its own criminal investigation, and the state probe is continuing. Meanwhile, the latest flight surveys show the windswept, gloppy crude heading westward from Prince William Sound toward Kenai Fjords National Park. The latest information from the Department of Environmental Conservation shows the oil at the mouth of Resurrection Bay, which is the entrance to the Port of Seward. DEC's Marshall Kenzoriak is one of the people responsible for plotting the flight survey data onto maps of the area.
What we're doing is it's gotten so big that we have to have two groups flying this because we just can't do it with one anymore. And we're actually getting to the point where we're limiting how far we can go by how much fuel the planes can carry.
Maps showing the prevailing currents in the area indicate that the oil may be pulled into Resurrection Bay. In another development, the Coast Guard announced that daylight-only restrictions on continued tanker traffic have been reimposed. Those restrictions had been lifted by the port commander in an attempt to ease the bottleneck of tankers lining up outside Prince William Sound to receive North Slope crude. The cutback has prompted warnings that some oil producers may not be able to fulfill all their contracts on the West Coast. But after the state and environmental groups pointed out that Alyeska's cleanup equipment was tied up with this spill and therefore not ready to deal with another spill, the Coast Guard slapped the night tanker ban back on. Lieutenant Edward Moreth says the restrictions will remain in place until Alyeska has proven it can handle another spill.
Till the determination of adequate response equipment and other information is obtained by the state.
The best news of the day, and the only good publicity Exxon has received since the spill, involved the Cordova Fishermen's Union and the Prince William Sound Aquaculture Association. Following a meeting with Exxon officials brought about by the district's legislators and VECO President Bill Allen, Exxon agreed to wire $1 million to the groups to enable them to buy protective booms and have them shipped to Cordova. Aquaculture Vice President Dan Warren says the group has been fighting what he called the confusion in Valdez since Friday to try and get some money directly into Cordova to help protect their stocks. And he says now that they have Exxon's money in the bank, they can renew their efforts. Senator Mike Szymanski says the deal was struck with Exxon Shipping President Frank Iarossi on the strength of a handshake. Szymanski also reports problems arising with the legislature's attempts to approve a $20 million emergency fund for cleanup expenses. He says the law won't allow retroactive collection from Exxon. So Szymanski and Senator Jay Kurtula introduced another bill in the Senate that would correct that problem and allow the state to be reimbursed for any costs dating back to the time of the spill. The $20 million appropriation was changed in the Senate to a $10 million grant from the state's general fund and authorization to receive another $10 million from another source, presumably Exxon. The state expects eventually to get all its money back. For APRN in Valdez, I'm Peter Kenyon.
The spring herring season in Prince William Sound has been canceled. Biologists in Cordova made that announcement today, and as Brian Mann reports, fishermen see no alternative.
The Department of Fish and Game's decision came as no surprise to fishermen here. James Brady, the Cordova area biologist, announced that the oil spill is simply too severe impacting three-quarters of the spawning ground used by herring in 1988. Surprise or no, the move was met emotionally by fishermen who support the decision but say it'll be tough to weather. Seiners, gill netters, wild kelp, and pound fishermen, all of which target the herring's lucrative roe, were expecting a harvest of between $12 and $20 million this spring. Astral Saddam is a purse seiner and skipper of the Anika. He says he was expecting to make some boat payments with his profits from Prince William Sound. Now he'll head on to Kodiak empty. All the fishermen here have the same problem, he says. Big investments, big payments. But if there's any chance of harvesting herring polluted by oil, he adds, the decision was a good one. Michelle Hahn O'Leary agreed, pointing out that product from Prince William Sound will be closely checked for contamination in the future. O'Leary is a pound fisherman who harvests the herring roe in artificial kelp pens. For the stocks and for the sake of future markets, she says it's better not to risk fishing this year. Directly impacted by the decision are over 300 permit holders licensed to take part in various fisheries. The people on shore are worried, too. Cordova's Main Street economy rests solely on fishing, and John Stavick, manager of a local bank, says retail merchants will suffer immediately. He says, quote, almost everything will decline. The only good news so far is that wind conditions have kept the oil flowing southward, away from Valdez Arm and other northern shorelines. The ADF&G's Jim Brady says those areas are valuable herring and salmon spawning grounds, and so far remain relatively untainted. Fingers are crossed that the winds won't shift. In Cordova, I'm Brian Mann.
Lance Trasky is with the Department of Fish and Game Habitat Division. He's reviewed most of the studies having to do with the impact of crude oil on herring, and the results make for grim reading. He told us this afternoon that both adult and larval herring can be affected by very small concentrations of oil in the water.
Anything in the low parts per billion range is probably adequate to kill adult herring. And in the upper parts per billion range, there's been studies that have shown that that significantly reduces the hatching success of herring eggs. And they've shown that, quantities of oil in the water in the low parts per billion range affect herring behavior. And another interesting sidelight is that there have been studies done, and actually were done by the National Marine Fisheries Service, and other researchers that show that herring larvae apparently are not able to detect or avoid oil spills. In fact, when they tested them, they would swim up into the spill until they finally were overcome and died.
Well, so I know it's difficult to predict, but what generally would you say this means for the future of herring in the Sound?
I think that there is, for a lot of reasons, very good reason to be concerned that there may be very significant impacts to the herring fishery, the production of herring, and any herring spawning this year. I mean, there's a chance that very significant damage could occur. There's an additional problem that people need to think about, and that is the potential for taining of herring, both through taking up oil from the water column. Usually they take it in through their gills or the food that they ingest and then incorporate it into their flesh or the eggs. And people can detect oil in fish at levels that are below the detectable limits by using, the normal chemical or, even gas chromatography. So there's that potential. The other potential is there's so much oil out in the water that if people are fishing out there, seining herring, that it's very likely that they would sein up oil along with the herring, and the herring would be oiled that way and would not be marketable, for human consumption.
Lance Trasky of Fish and Game's Habitat Division. He spoke with us this afternoon from Anchorage. Our reporters in Valdez have been getting out into the field for some first-hand experience of the spill and the cleanup attempts. Bob King flew out to Green Island yesterday on board a Fish and Game helicopter. He prepared this report.
Ironically, what strikes you when you arrive on Green Island is how clean it is. while most coastal beaches, even those in remote parts of Alaska, are littered with fishing floats, discarded nets, plastic bottles, and styrofoam cups, Green Island is remarkably immaculate. Protected inside the sound, it is free of what's become everyday marine pollution. The sheltered waters of Gibbon Cove also seem surprisingly free of the oil which is spilled from the Exxon Valdez. There is a line of tar along the beach, though, and a light sheen on the water. And everywhere there is evidence of the deadliness of the spill. In less than a quarter of a mile, John Lyman with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game has filled a bag with the bodies of dead birds.
Oh, I don't know. There's close to a dozen. I could have picked up about four or five times as many, I'm sure, but the bag's tearing up. These birds weigh ounces each, you know? And maybe close to a dozen birds. And they're tearing out this heavy-duty industrial plastic bag.
Their natural coloring makes the birds hard to find. Their motionless bodies easily blend in with the rock and gravel shoreline. Fish and Game estimates that only 1 in 10 will be found. They are even hard for a trained eye to spot. Kathy Dawson is a freelance photographer working for Audubon magazine. Her subject is a horned grebe, a small seabird with bright red eyes. The grebe was floating in the water, furiously preening itself, trying to get oil off of its feathers. Shivering, the bird comes out of the water right in front of the camera.
It's not a good sign that this bird is constantly coming to shore like this, even though we're here, that he's coming right up here and preening on shore. That means that they're cold, for one, because they've lost their insulation, and they need to get out of that water before they get hypothermic. So he's definitely in need of cleaning.
The grebe tucks its head under its wing, trying to sleep. Fearful that it will not wake, John Lyman takes off his undershirt to wrap the bird in. Normally, the bird would flee from an approaching human, but the shivering grebe surrenders without a fight. After helping the rescue, Kathy Dawson turns her camera on another bird that does not seem to be oiled.
I'm focusing on the oyster catcher, who appears to be very healthy, but he's feeding in on a beach that has got oil here and there, and I'm sure a sheen over the whole beach. So whether he knows it or not, he's probably gonna ingest this. But he's just oblivious. He's just walking along in nice late evening sunlight, feeding away, picking up all kinds of things, not knowing what he's doing to himself.
The sheltered waters where the grebe and the oyster catcher were found are relatively clean. On the other side of a protecting isthmus, however, on a beach facing to the northeast, to where the Exxon Valdez ran aground, oil is thick on the rocks. In places, it has pooled several inches thick. The bodies of dead birds collect along the high tide line. They are virtually unrecognizable from the other oil-soaked debris. Also here, the struggle for life is more difficult. Anchorage Times photographer Al Grillo has found an oil-soaked yellowbill hidden in the rocks and tries to capture it with a plastic bag.
Watch your eyes. Keep it low. Hold it low. Go check out your eyes. Oh, shit.
The cleanup and rescue operation has not just been physically tiring. It's been an emotionally draining process, one which seems to have no immediate end. Kathy Dawson came to Prince William Sound the day after the Exxon Valdez ran aground.
It's been tough. This is the first day I've really started to see the impact on the wildlife, except for at the Bird Rehab Center. I've seen it there, the otters. That's really sad. It's just shocking to come out here and sit down on these beaches and see that oil. And the most I've seen in the way of wildlife in the oil has just been dead ducks floating. But it is really overwhelming to think that anything is going to survive when you're sitting on one of those beaches and you're standing in 2 inches of solid oil. It's going to be a dead zone.
The cleanup of oil on Green Island has not yet begun. There are no crews on the beaches, no skimmers trying to remove the slicks of heavy oil that lap up. Some fishing boats are anchored nearby, part of the animal rescue effort. The bodies of dead birds and otters are collected before they can be scavenged. The live animals, like the grebe and the yellowbill, are brought to Valdez, where they face an uncertain rehabilitation. Reporter Claire Richardson visited the rehab center in Valdez.
The whir of blow dryers trained on the drying otters is continuous. The smell of fish is everywhere. The distressed otters lie on ledges in individual makeshift boxes. They can dip into a shallow bath when they feel like it or cry and wait for volunteers to offer them some pollock, shrimp, or crab. Marilyn Dudley from SeaWorld in San Diego, California says otters usually eat one quarter of their body weight every day.
Unfortunately, a lot of these animals, we don't know how long they've been oiled. They've lost an incredible amount of weight. For a sea otter, it only takes a matter of 48 hours before it loses enough weight where it could be critically ill. So we're just trying to get them the oil off of them. We're trying to just get them fed up and, back on their flippers again. But it may be a matter of, several days to several weeks for some of them.
Of the 41 otters treated so far in Valdez, 18 have died. The center ran out of room Sunday evening, and on Tuesday, the gym at the elementary school will reopen as the new Otter Rescue Center with room for 80. A half dozen of the otters are on their way to SeaWorld for rehabilitation. Later, they'll be released in Alaskan waters. More than 100 oiled birds have been brought alive to Valdez for cleaning. Only a few have died so far. Exxon hired the Bird Rescue Research Center from Berkeley, California, to oversee the operation. Veterinarian Jessica Porter never stopped washing a duck as she explained how the oil is removed.
A lot of people think it's the oil in the feathers of birds that cause them to be waterproof, and that's not true. There's virtually no oil on the feathers of birds. What you have got is a situation where you've got a basket lining of feathers lining that bird, and you get oil in it, and it's like getting a hole in the wetsuit. And the way the feathers lie is what keeps the water away from the skin. You can't submerge the head and scrub it up, so what we have to do is use a water pick first to loosen up the oil around the feathers, especially around the nose and around the eyes, and be relatively gentle and really concentrated. And then go ahead and use a toothbrush. And when you use a toothbrush, it's amazing how much oil you get off the face.
After years of testing different soaps, the Bird Institute chose the disc detergent Dawn for cleaning oil off of the birds. Just marshaling the forces needed to make the center run smoothly is Alice Berkner's job.
The logistics of getting these birds in here is it's something to be reckoned with, but we're getting that under control, and a lot of that is due to the cooperation of all the people here in Valdez over at Cordova, where we've got some boats coming in from there, and there's a lot that we would not have been able to do without local expertise.
The Audubon Society in Anchorage donated sheets and towels that are being used to cover the bird pens and dry the ducks, loons, and scoters. The Department of Environmental Conservation says the spill continues to threaten wildlife. At this time of year, there are between 300,000 to 400,000 birds at Prince William Sound, but that will increase as the season progresses to 500,000. And over the next few weeks, 1 million waterfowl and more than 10 million shorebirds will pass through the sound. In Valdez, I'm Claire Richardson.
The National Park Service response team for the spill has set up shop in Seward. They've pulled in experts from the Park Service, the Forest Service, and other agencies all over the United States. 37 people are now working out of a small house overlooking Resurrection Bay. Sue Burris paid them a visit and filed this report.
The hand-lettered cardboard sign thumbtacked to the porch reads, "All new incoming personnel check in at plans in the basement." Dixie Dees, in charge of public information, sits at the kitchen table with her telephone, fielding calls from all over the world as the oil from the Exxon Valdez slips out of Prince William Sound toward the Kenai Fjords National Park.
The Park Service realized that they were at the front of the spill, or could be, and that they needed to get in some people, professional managers, to organize data collection. And to be able to prioritize if the oil spill ever got there, what needed to be saved and what couldn't.
The other part of their mission is to take inventory of all the wildlife and vegetation in the Kenai Fjords. The Park Service had data on the area for later in the summer, but not this early in the spring. A map on the living room wall charts known favorite spots for humpback and gray whales, seabird colonies, sea otters, sea lions, brown bears, and bald eagles. Biologists and ecologists are counting and taking samples so they'll know what's there now, today. The map that charts the progression of the oil also shows gray whales here and other wildlife sightings. The maps have transformed the living room into a command center. Dave Liebersbach is the incident commander for the Park Service.
This week, if it's coming, is when the oil's going to hit. And we need to know, are the seals in this bay or are they in this bay? No use protecting this bay because if they're in the other bay. And there's going to be a limited capability of protection. We're not going to be able to protect everybody working on this, including Exxon and the Coast Guard, are not going to be able to protect everything. And we know that. Now we have to prioritize that protection to maximize the effectiveness of it and to get the most bang for the buck, so to speak, or for the boom in this case, the most bang for the boom.
Liebersbach says containment booms will be used to protect the most sensitive areas and save the greatest number of animals. Some has been laid today in areas closest to the oncoming oil. But last week there was a shortage of the material.
But that's turning around as these outfits are turning it out at an emergency pace. Down below, the companies are to get it up to Alaska to assist in this.
The city of Seward went ahead and bought its own containment booms from a supplier on the East Coast. About 2 miles of bright orange boom sits neatly folded by the harbor. The packing cartons are still stacked nearby. 2 miles doesn't seem like much when you look at the vast area the oil could hit, but it's a start, and everyone is thankful they had a few days to get ready. For APRN, I'm Sue Burris.
Reaction to the Exxon spill erupted this afternoon 350 miles from Valdez. The Alaska Center for the Environment held a rally in downtown Anchorage. Robert Hawk reports.
A crowd of about 200 showed up to sign volunteer sheets, pledge donations to a new Prince William Sound cleanup fund, and to show their feelings with pickets and banners. Some of the signs read, "Save Our Sound" and "Exxon Failed." Others urged Exxon to get more oil booms and equipment online to protect as-yet-unpolluted waterways. Rally organizer Sue Liebenson was the first to speak to the crowd. She said the rally was called to give a message to anyone in the world who would listen.
To Exxon and the other oil companies who have remained silent, to our congressional delegation and our president, to the members of Congress and the citizens they represent, a message that we are angered by the dim, chaotic response to this disaster, that we are incensed by the policies and practices that allowed this spill to range completely out of control, and that we are insulted by offhand comments intended to cover up the magnitude of this crisis. We look to our government and our fellow citizens for support as we pledge our long-term commitment to clean up and restoring the sound we love.
Liebenson announced the formation of a Prince William Sound cleanup fund. She says the purpose of the fund is not to cover the cost to be borne by Exxon, but to provide a long-term source of money for ongoing cleanup once the spill fades from the headlines. Marsha Hodson with the Prince William Sound Conservation Alliance urged the crowd to mount letter-writing campaigns to their elected officials, and she mentioned a day of memorial to be set aside later this month.
You too can go write letters. You too can buy postcards. You too have families located throughout the United States. This can be an effort. I really want to thank Ann Whelan for her inspiration for Prince William Sound Day, because I think it is a time that we need to channel our energy into a peaceful movement that will help people to understand the sacrifice that we had to make to begin a shift in our conscious awareness of using petroleum products. We are a land in frenzy, and we do need to make that change. And all of us can start right here. And I encourage you to be patient, to put your names on the list, and to pray with me for the people in Prince William Sound who are now working so desperately to hold on to their livelihood.
Prince William Sound Day is set for April 23rd. Environmental groups are asking people across the state to observe 5 minutes of silence to preserve the memory of the sound before the giant oil spill. The last speaker at Monday's rally was environmental advocate Jim Sykes. He challenged big government and big oil with a question and answer exchange.
Exxon and Alyeska are making millions more profits because the price of oil went up following this bill. Now tell me, is that fair?
No!
The second thing is, an Exxon spokesman was quoted as saying they're going to write the cleanup off on their taxes. Is that fair?
No!
Well, then that leaves Alaskans and the wildlife and the ecosystem of Prince William Sound to suffer. And because of that, the rest of America gets to pick up the tab by paying more for petroleum products and giving these people a tax break. Is that fair?
No!
Okay. Are we going to open Bristol Bay?
No!
Are we going to open Anwar?
No!
Thank you.
Jim Sykes and other speakers at a rally Monday in front of the federal courthouse in Anchorage. In Anchorage, I'm Robert Hawk.
Susan Butcher has won the Kobuk 440 sled dog race. At least, it looks that way. Jeff Kennedy has the story.
Susan Butcher took a shortcut from the last official checkpoint at Norvik to the finish line in Kotzebue. That turn saved her 7 miles, but cost her an hour, the penalty imposed by race marshal Chuck Schaefer. Even with that penalty, Butcher would win by more than 3 hours over second-place finisher Ed Eaton of Kobuk. Other finishers have 24 hours to protest that decision. As of mid-afternoon, three more mushers had completed the race from Kotzebue to Kobuk and back. Kathy Swenson in third place. Previously undefeated Sonny Russell in fourth place, and former Iditarod musher Lucy Nordlum fifth. Unless the Kotzebue Dog Mushers Association Board overturns the race marshal's decision, Susan Butcher has taken the Kobuk 440 and the $10,000 first prize. In Kotzebue, I'm Jeff Kennedy.
And that's Alaska News Nightly for this Monday, the 3rd of April. We had reports tonight from Brian Mann in Cordova and Claire Richardson in Valdez for KCHU. KDLG's Bob King reported from Valdez, Robert Hawk of KSKA from Anchorage, and Jeff Kennedy of KOTZ from Kotzebue. APRN's Peter Kenyon reported from Valdez and Sue Burris from Seward. Our theme music is composed and performed by Gary Rowe. Diana Derby is our engineer with production assistance from Larry Yarrow. APRN's Chris Badalek is engineering at KCHU in Valdez, along with Jeff Brown from KTOO. I'm Corey Flintoff.
Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations and Cook Inlet Region Incorporated, promoting social progress and economic development for people throughout the state. This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network. Alaska News Nightly is made possible by APRN member stations and the Sheraton Anchorage Hotel, the hospitality people.
From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly. The plan for refloating the crippled tanker Exxon Valdez is coming together, and people in the ever-widening path of its giant oil spill are coming together too, hoping to protect their coastlines. Good evening, I'm Corey Flintoff. We have a lot more on the Exxon disaster tonight, and news from the Capitol, too, as Governor Cooper and legislative leaders reach accord on $186 million worth of budget cuts. Salvage experts plan to force compressed air into the hull of the Exxon Valdez tomorrow and float the 1,000-foot tanker off the rocks. The ship will be patched up in Prince William Sound, but where it eventually goes for repairs is still undecided. Bob King reports.
Liftoff, as Exxon Shipping Company President Frank Iarossi put it, is scheduled for Wednesday afternoon's high tide, about 1:30.
And what we will be doing is applying air pressure in the airspace of the damaged tanks above that water, and in effect, forcing the bottom 3 feet of seawater out through the bottom of the vessel. That will give us enough buoyancy to lift the vessel, and you see the lines we are showing in red is the position of the vessel as it has been refloated.
Once refloated, the tanker will be towed 25 miles to Naked Island. About 15,000 barrels of oil remain aboard the Exxon Valdez, but it's considered unrecoverable. Iarossi says that oil should not leak out, since there's 30 feet of seawater beneath it. Naked Island, though, was chosen in part because it's already contaminated. There, the ship will be patched up for eventual repair, but just where that work will be done is not certain. Portland, Oregon has been reluctant to let the notorious tanker into port. British Columbia is even worried about it passing by their coast. Iarossi said Exxon was considering other locations for the repair work.
We have also opened discussions with ship repair organizations in Korea, Japan, and Singapore. We know Singapore has exactly the same problem as Portland, and that their facilities are very heavily booked. What we really have to do now is find somebody who has the time to take this vessel, because it'll be a fairly lengthy process.
The folks in Portland are somewhat concerned about the possibility of pollution trailing the vessel. Do you have any comment on that?
Before we leave Prince William Sound, there won't be any pollution trailing the vessel.
Meanwhile, the oil continues to stream past the San Juan hatchery. Iarossi said some sheen had been spotted within the first of three layers of defense, but skimmers quickly gathered that up. Iarossi said the battle of Sawmill Bay will likely continue for 3 or 4 more days. It remains a top priority.